The Outline of History by H.G. Wells, continued.
Disc 4.
Practically, this Congress was an insurrectionary government, but no blow was struck until the spring of 1775. Then came the first shedding of blood. Two of the American leaders, Hancock and Samuel Adams, had been marked down by the British government for arrest and trial for treason. They were known to be at Lexington, about 11 miles from Boston. And in the night of April the 18th, 1775, Gage set his forces in motion for their arrest. That night was a momentous one in history. The movement of Gage's troops had been observed. Signal lanterns were shown from a church tower in Boston, and two men, Dawes and Paul Revere, stole away in boats across the Back Bay to take horse and warm the countryside. The British were also ferried over the water, and as they marched through the night towards Lexington, the firing of signal cannon and the ringing of church bells went before them. As they entered Lexington at dawn, they saw a little company of men drawn up in military fashion. It seems that the British fired first. There was a single shot, and then a volley, and the whole handful decamped, apparently without any answering shots, leaving 8 dead and 9 wounded upon the village green. The British then marched on to Concord, 10 miles further, occupied the village, and stationed a party on the bridge at that place. The expedition had failed in its purpose of arresting Hancock and Adams, and the British commander seems to have been at a loss what to do next. Meanwhile, the colonial levies were coming up from all directions, and presently the picket upon the bridge found itself subjected to an increasing fire from a gathering number of assailants firing from behind trees and fences. A retreat to Boston was decided upon. It was a disastrous retreat. The country had risen behind the British. All the morning the colonials had been gathering. Both sides of the road were now swarming with sharpshooters, firing from behind rock and fence and building. The soldiers were in conspicuous scarlet uniforms with yellow facings and white gaiters and cravats. This must have stood out very vividly against the cold, sharp colours of the late New England spring. The day was bright, hot, and dusty, and they were already exhausted by a night march. Every few yards a man fell, wounded or killed. The rest tramped on or halted to fire an ineffectual volley. No counterattack was possible. Their assailants lurked everywhere. At Lexington there were British reinforcements and 2 guns, and after a brief rest the retreat was resumed in better order. But the sharpshooting and pursuit was pressed to the river, and after the British had crossed back into Boston, the colonial levies took up their quarters in Cambridge and prepared to blockade the city. 4. So the war began. It wasn't a war that promised a conclusive end. The colonists had no one vulnerable capital. They were dispersed over a great country with a limitless wilderness behind it, and so they had great powers of resistance. They had learnt their tactics largely from the Indians. They could fight well in open order and harry and destroy troops in movement. But they had no disciplined army that could meet the British in a pitched battle, and little military equipment, and their levies grew impatient at a long campaign and tended to go home to their farms. The British, on the other hand, had a well-drilled army, and their command of the sea gave them the power of shifting their attack up and down the long Atlantic seaboard. They were at peace with all the world, but the king was stupid and greedy to interfere in the conduct of affairs. The generals he favoured were stupid, strong men, or flighty men of birth and fashion, and the heart of Britain was not in the business. He trusted rather to being able to blockade, raid, and annoy the colonists into submission than to a conclusive conquest and occupation of the land. But the methods employed, and particularly the use of hired German troops who still retained the cruel traditions of the 30 Years' War, and of Indian auxiliaries who harried the outlying settlers, didn't so much weary the Americans of the war as of the British. The Congress, meeting for the second time in 1775, endorsed the actions of the New England colonists and appointed George Washington the American commander-in-chief. In 1777, General Burgoyne, in an attempt to get down to New York from Canada, was defeated at Freeman's Farm on the Upper Hudson and surrounded and obliged to capitulate at Saratoga with his whole army. This disaster encouraged the French and Spanish to come into the struggle on the side of the colonists. The French sent General Lafayette to the States to assist them with his advice, and their fleet did much to minimize the advantage of the British at sea. General Cornwallis was caught in the Yorktown Peninsula in Virginia in 1781 and capitulated with his army. The British government, now heavily engaged with France and Spain in Europe, was at the end of its resources. At the outset of the war, the colonists in general seemed to have been as little disposed to repudiate monarchy and claim complete independence as were the Hollanders in the opening phase of Philip II's persecutions and follies. The separatists were called radicals. They were mostly extremely democratic, as we should say in England today, and their advanced views frightened many of the steadier and wealthier colonists for whom class privileges and distinctions had considerable charm. But early in 1776, an able and persuasive Englishman, Thomas Paine, published a pamphlet at Philadelphia with the title of Common Sense, which had an enormous effect on public opinion. Its style was rhetorical by modern standards. The blood of the slain, the weeping voice of nature cries, 'Tis time to part,' and so forth. But its effects were very great. It converted thousands to the necessity of separation. The turnover of opinion once it had begun was rapid. Only in the summer of 1776 did Congress take the irrevocable step of declaring for separation. The Declaration of Independence, another of those exemplary documents which it has been the peculiar service of the English to produce for mankind, was drawn up by Thomas Jefferson, and after various amendments and modifications it was made the fundamental document of the United States of America. There were two noteworthy amendments to Jefferson's draft. He had denounced the slave trade fiercely, and blamed the home government for interfering with colonial attempts to end it. This was thrown out, and so too was a sentence about the British, "We must endeavour to forget our former love for them, we might have been a free and great people together." Towards the end of 1782, the preliminary articles of the treaty in which Britain recognised the complete independence of the United States were signed at Paris. The end of the war was proclaimed on April the 19th, 1783, exactly 8 years after Paul Revere's ride and the retreat of Gage's men from Concord to Boston. The Treaty of Peace was finally signed at Paris in September. Fifth, from the point of view of human history, the way in which the 13 states became independent is of far less importance than the fact that they did become independent. And with the establishment of their independence came a new sort of community into the world. It was like something coming out of an egg. It was a Western European civilization that had broken free from the last traces of empire and Christendom. It hadn't a vestige of monarchy left, and no state religion. It had no dukes, princes, counts, nor any sort of title-bearers claiming to ascendancy or respect as a right. Even its unity was as yet a mere unity for defence and freedom.